At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 310, Great Debates in Fitness and in Health. That's the ninth time we're doing this. We're just debating Dr. Baraki. Dr. Baraki, speaking of him, he's the second most handsome doctor in North America. He's on the other end of the line. What's going on, man?
Hey, yeah, I guess we're never really going to run out of things to debate. I just opened up the document. I have not yet looked at any of the debate propositions yet, so ready to be surprised today.
Yeah. Well, look, there's just controversial things out there, and that gives us fodder to talk about, so I'm happy for that. At some point, all of the questions on the internet will have been answered relating to health and fitness, and then we retire, which is fine. Yeah. Big enigma is not going to rue the day. We'll just retire before that. Before we get into the podcast, and of course, we do have a mystery case, a few announcements. Again, we do have a number of free tools and resources over on our website. So calculators for everything from how many calories should you be eating, if that's something of interest to you, a macro calculator, a 1RM calculator, heart rate zone calculator, all that stuff's for free over on our website. Just go to the website, barbellmedicine.com, click About Us, click Resources. It'll take you there. Also, the Android app is available on the Google Play Store. So if you're a Green Bubble person, you can go to the Google Play Store, download our app for free, and get the first week of all of our templates for free on the app. So if you're on the fence about that, one of our new training templates. We also have a template quiz that is available. It's in the link in the description below. It basically took how I recommend templates to people and codified that and put it into a little quiz. You can figure out what I would recommend to you. And then finally, we have an upcoming pain and rehab seminar in Atlanta, Georgia. It's in October. It's approved for continuing education units if you're a physical therapist in the area. So you can check that out. It's all linked in the description below. Now, before we get into this week's great debates, I guess we should just talk briefly about Raw Nationals. Austin, it's my 11th Raw Nationals.
That's a feat. I'm impressed.
Are you impressed? Yeah. Well,
Tell me about it.
I was there when it all started, 2012, killing Texas in a church. I actually believe 2011 was the very first year I wasn't in powerlifting, at least not at that level. But yeah, I went every year except for 2016, which I believe was Atlanta. That was intern year. Could not get away from that. Turns out program director was not sympathetic to my need to go attend Raw Nationals. But no, it was cool. You know, sometimes I think we've been doing this for too long, or I've been doing this for too long, that we've just sort of like aged out maybe of, you know, the current crop of powerlifters, for example, or like, I don't know, maybe barbell medicine is moving out of powerlifting because we don't compete as frequently as we used to. That doesn't seem to be the case. If anything, I mean, I must have taken more selfies, had more conversations about our podcast or our material or whatever than I think I ever have. It was really cool, really uplifting.
Well, that's great.
My heart is full. It was cool. Like if you came up to, if we talked, especially if you're a healthcare professional, that was my main takeaway. A lot of physicians were there and they were like, I love your stuff. I recommend it to my residents, for example. I was like, cool. Like unbeknownst to me, or people that are actively in the medical school application process.
Sure.
And they were like, we love your stuff and hope I get in, and hopefully, you know, we can do stuff like you in the future. I'm like, I mean, aim higher than that, but it was cool.
Yeah. Nice.
But yeah, Leah won her class. So she won. Brian Drzezinski got third. We had a bunch of other medalists as well. People did really well. Nathan Kules, do you know him? Do you remember him from the Facebook group?
I recognize the name.
Yeah, he runs our templates like almost exclusively, right? And he won his class as well. He squatted 660, 100 kilo class, squatted 660, pulled 327, I think, something like that, which is
confusing people because you're mixing pounds and kilos.
Oh, yeah. Well, he pulled 330 kilos, right?
Yeah.
So set was at 727, which was a record. And Yeah. He's like, I love your templates. I just run them. And I'm like, that's amazing. Like, I wasn't building them specifically
average.
For you.
Yeah, hyper responder, let's say.
Totally, totally. Yeah, he went off. And then one of Leah's clients, Patty, she's in one of the lighter weight women's classes, and she pulled a record. She beat her own deadlift record. I believe it was 180 kilos, so 396, which is like – she's closing out on like a 4X body weight deadlift, which is
legit. Yeah,
very legit.
Pretty good showing.
Yeah, I mean, again, for just you know, a bunch of medical folks who dabble in some powerlifting, yeah, we did okay. So, yeah. A lot of people were like, "Where's Dr. Baraki? Where's the second most handsome doctor in North America?" I'm like, you were working, you were in the hospital, huh?
Yeah, I was not available at the time. maybe another year. Yeah.
Yeah, next time you can be there for game day coaching, you can apply baby powder before deadlifts. That'll be your – yeah. All right. Well, let's get into the main portion of this podcast, great debates. Now, what we do here, we are forced to take some interesting positions because, in general, Dr. Baraki and I agree on most things. Otherwise, I don't think this you know, relationship would have worked. But what you find is when somebody is an actual expert in a particular topic, they are aware of the evidence base for that entire topic. And some things may contrast with their sort of prevailing view or the recommendations, but they're aware nonetheless. And so they're able to usually articulate both sides of an argument or of a claim, if there are any. And so that's kind of what we attempt to do in order to further your understanding and maybe give you guys some things to think about. As far as the rules or the format, this is a loose program. Again, we don't stick to this, but we try. It's 5 minutes per question. You get the person who goes first, picks the affirmative or negative, and they get 2 minutes to kind of go off. And then the other person has to take the opposite view. They get another 2 minute response. And then the person who let it off gets a 1 minute rebuttal and will alternate who goes first. And again, don't like set your watches to this. We definitely don't stick to that 2 minutes, but we try. All right, Austin, because you got the case right and I didn't believe in you, you get to pick, you get to go first on this one. All right. So question number one, this has to do with anti-obesity medicines. So something we've talked about a few times on the podcast, and we're going to be talking about excessive lean body mass loss. So barring changes in body water, which are typically short term, body weight is the result of energy balance. If the amount of energy going into the system is greater than the amount of energy going out, the body weight will go up proportional to the energy surplus. Similarly, when the amount of energy going out of the system is greater than the amount of energy going in, body weight will go down, again, proportional to the energy deficit. Now, if the energy coming into the system perfectly matches the energy going out, body weight shouldn't change, as this equilibrium is known as maintenance. Now, when people lose weight, the rule that's quoted most often is this 1/4 fat-free mass rule, which describes the relevant contributions of fat and lean tissue during weight loss. However, this rule is more of an approximation than anything else, as there are a number of variables that can affect the proportions of fat and lean tissue loss. This includes stuff like protein intake, exercise status, medication use, health conditions, genetics, and more. Now, anti-obesity medications like semaglutide have been scrutinized for causing, quote, excess lean mass loss. In the Step 1 trial, for example, the average amount of weight loss was 17.4 kilograms in those using semaglutide compared to 2.7 kilograms for those individuals using the placebo. Now, of this, about 40% of the mass of the weight that was lost was fat-free mass. That just means it's not fat mass. So that can be things like water, it can be things like glycogen, and it can be things like muscle mass. Interestingly, over half the weight loss in the placebo group was fat-free mass too, 55%, as I recall off the top of my head. In the SURMOUNT-1 trial, it's another study, which tested tirzepatide over 72 weeks, the group getting the highest dose of medication lost 23.6 kilograms, whereas the placebo group only lost 2.4 kilos. About a third of the weight lost in both the medication and placebo groups was fat-free mass. Again, that's not just muscle tissue, but that's anything that's not fat. Finally, a recent study where those on liraglutide, which is another type of GLP-1, it's probably the worst one as far as like actual weight loss results, but we've had it around for over 15 years. It showed that those who were on liraglutide who also exercised, they tended to lose the most amount of fat mass. And when they exercised, they didn't seem to lose any more lean mass than those who just exercise alone. They just lost a lot more fat mass than them. Now, a recent commentary was published in The Lancet that suggested that the apparent excess muscle loss via GLP-1 receptor agonists like semaglutide and similar medications suggests that the loss of muscle may be more risky than the benefits offered by fat loss. So the premise for this first debate is excess muscle loss from using anti-obesity medicines like semaglutide is a big concern that warrants careful consideration for individuals seeking a prescription. Austin, what say you?
All right. Long preamble and long premise. I'm going to view this. I'm going to kind of Mad Lib that premise and substitute a few terms to try to make a point. So instead of saying excess muscle loss from anti-obesity medicines is a big concern that warrants careful consideration for individuals seeking a prescription, I'll say bleeding from the use of aspirin is a big concern that warrants careful consideration for individuals seeking a prescription. When I say it like that, any clinician who is anywhere around these medicines will readily recognize the calculus that is at play when we make these kinds of decisions. There are patients for whom, starting them on aspirin, we have clear and direct evidence that it will markedly reduce their risk, for example, of having a recurrent heart attack or stroke or other kind of cardiovascular complication. And while they may be at some increased risk of bleeding, the benefit in terms of reducing their risk of heart attack or stroke by outcome measures in human trials of this medicine far outweighs the bleeding risk. There are other patients who do not stand to benefit so much from taking aspirin for cardiovascular risk reduction. For example, a perfectly healthy 30-year-old who has no, you know, cardiovascular disease, they don't really stand to benefit from taking aspirin for heart attacks, whereas they may experience some bleeding. In that context, the bleeding risk may actually outweigh the cardiovascular risk reduction that they stand to gain, and so you would not use it in that population. The same approach to clinical decision-making would apply when it comes to anti-obesity medicines. We recognize that when people lose weight, whether through diet, exercise, lifestyle, medication, surgery, a fraction of that weight loss is going to be fat mass, a fraction will be lean mass. It is perfectly valid to question or to raise concerns about what is the actual consequence of this loss of lean body mass, this muscle mass. Is that something I should be so concerned about? Well, the same types of mental decision-making should apply. In the trials where these drugs have not just been examined for their outcomes on weight loss, but on actual health-related outcomes, which we have an increasing volume of these studies in recent years. For example, looking at GLP-1 receptor agonists in patients with heart failure, looking at these in patients with diabetes for cardiovascular disease outcomes, looking at this in patients with chronic kidney disease. All of these studies have now already been done with multiple of these agents. And so in those situations, if we put a patient on these medicines and they lose a bunch of weight, and as a result of inducing lean body mass loss, potentially, let's say in the most catastrophic scenario, somehow you cause them to develop sarcopenia and the doctor does not recognize that he's making his patient cachectic and frail and continues the medicine, and it starts killing them more, we would see that in the outcomes. Conversely, if we see putting these patients on these medicines, despite the lean body mass loss, we see them die less. We see them have less heart failure complications, less chronic kidney disease complications. We see tirzepatide as the most potent example, and almost 90%+ reduced risk of progression to diabetes and its subsequent outcomes, which are very prevalent and pretty dangerous, potentially lethal. And we don't see a signal of direct harm, right? We see the benefit clearly outweighing the harm. Then the same calculus would apply as what I said earlier. In the appropriately selected patient, they should be taking aspirin, for example, even though they might bleed. These are patients who strongly stand to benefit from these medicines, even if they lose a little bit of lean body mass. Now, the other side of this coin, much like when I said the healthy 30-year-old probably isn't going to need to be on aspirin because they're going to be more likely to bleed and not really going to prevent a heart attack. If I have a completely healthy 25-year-old whose waist measurement is not 37 inches, but instead is like 38 and a half inches, I'm probably not strongly recommending that they go on a GLP-1 receptor agonist as upfront immediate therapy, right? Or at the same time, a patient who is already thin and frail and doesn't have much lean body mass to spare, right? I'm also not starting those patients on GLP-1 receptor agonists. There's been, you know, one patient that I can think of that I saw in the hospital recently who had like active cancer and was losing weight from his cancer, but had been put on one of these medicines because they also had diabetes. And they're like, I have no appetite. I'm not eating. I'm losing weight and I have active cancer. And I'm like, yeah, we're going to stop this medicine because that makes no sense for you, right? So that's kind of the decision making around this is instead of it's hypothesis generating, like how concerned should we be? Just look at the actual outcomes and see, is it net harmful or net beneficial, and kind of practice accordingly. So that's my position on this is basically apply human outcomes to the patient in front of you based on the best evidence that you have.
So to be clear, are you taking the affirmative that this warrants careful consideration, or you're taking the negative?
Yeah, I think it should take careful consideration anytime you're prescribing a drug to a patient.
Fine. Well, I guess I'll have to take the negative that this does not warrant careful consideration. And so I'm going to force myself to contort in various ways to make my point, which is I think that this discussion around, quote, excess lean mass loss in GLP-1 agonists and at large, you know, anti-obesity medications, I think is overstated. So first off, we don't actually know if that's the case because, you know, what you're comparing is relatively large amounts of weight loss, okay, with a slightly you're comparing those relatively large amount of weight loss from these GLP-1 receptor agonists and other types of anti-obesity medications to relatively modest amounts of weight loss from lifestyle alone. And in general, the more weight that people lose, the more lean mass they're going to lose. Now, whether that's muscle, whether that's water, whether it's glycogen, it's all, you know, bone, et cetera. You're just, the more weight you lose in general, the more lean mass loss is going to happen. The problem is it's not apparently causing any negative signal in the evidence with respect to outcomes. That's thing one. Thing two, we don't know if this is some like direct result of the medication or a more, it's more descriptive of losing more mass, which bariatric metabolic surgery, for example, you have a similar amount of lean mass loss, right? And nobody's like clamoring, like, we're giving all these people sarcopenia. And just as an aside, sarcopenia is not just the loss of muscle mass. That's not what sarcopenia is. People say this all the time. Oh, loss of muscle mass, sarcopenia. Nope, that's not the definition of sarcopenia. Would recommend firing up the Google machine. Look up the European working group, their definition of sarcopenia, and go from there. You need some remediation for this. And further, the idea that you would lose so much muscle mass to cause a negative outcome in a patient where this was appropriately prescribed, to me, you know, that seems highly improbable. Yeah, I can imagine a case of somebody with like sarcopenic obesity, right? And you're like, oh, you give them a GLP-1 agonist. So that's you have a person who's got relatively low levels of muscle mass, poor muscle function, and has obesity. And you're like, well, should I put them on a GLP-1 agonist or something similar? It's like, well, one, maybe, depends what else is going on. But you weren't going to fix that sarcopenic obesity anyway. There are so many things that are wrong that led to that state that just losing some fat mass and getting rid of the obesity is, you know, that's probably beneficial, but that's a more nuanced topic that we need some evidence on. And so I'm kind of, you know, shoulder shrug on that. Here's the biggest thing. This particular commentary made a big to-do about, look, if you lose all this muscle mass and you're not pulling on the bones because you lost all this muscle mass, you're going to have osteoporosis, which you would presumably otherwise be protected against by maintaining obesity. Well, that's not the case either. You have a higher risk of fracture in individuals with obesity. The rates of osteoporosis are not like zero in individuals with obesity because it's inflammatory and can cause decreases in bone mineral density. It's more complex than that. So I guess if I have to contort myself, I'm just not worried about people losing too much muscle mass. One, I don't know if that's even true. It doesn't appear to be true by the existing evidence, and we would just need better data to really kind of tie a bow on that. But it's like, individuals with obesity have excess muscle mass anyway, and we see clearly the benefit of losing the excess body fat and without any apparent signal of like, oh, they lost too much muscle mass and now they're at higher risk for some sort of condition related to low levels of muscle mass. So I'm just not concerned about it, though I can appreciate how some people might see it differently. I just don't think that's really – you can support that with evidence.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean I see your position and it makes sense assuming like the most basic level of common sense in prescribing.
Right, prescribing
it to somebody who is thin and frail in the same way that I see somebody who is thin and frail or at significant risk of complications for sarcopenia, I'm probably not recommending that they proceed to the OR for their Roux-en-Y gastric bypass surgery, right?
Yeah.
And so if with that kind of basic common sense in mind, recognizing like what is the more likely hazard for this patient in the medium to long term? Is it cumulative effects of carrying excess body fat and the complications of that from a cardiometabolic standpoint, cancer standpoint, et cetera? Or is the more immediate risk that this patient has that they are too thin and frail to get up and carry themselves around, and I'm more worried that they're going to fall, fracture a hip, and die from that, in which case I'm probably not putting them on GLP-1 as my first line treatment. But that assumption of common sense may or may not be valid in all settings.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah. All right. Okay, just quick hot take here. Would health outcomes in general be better in the United States if people lost 10% body fat, okay, or gained 10% muscle mass? What would lead to better health outcomes?
I think this is pretty difficult to say, honestly. What I'm trying to do is to check my own like mental selection bias from the patients that I see in the hospital, right? For whom most of them, I think, would benefit more strongly from gaining a decent chunk of muscle mass and strength to where they could like take care of themselves and not be in a nursing home or a hospital or something like that. But broadly speaking, on a population wide level, you know, as far as like what are the most common, you know, causes of morbidity, mortality, cardiovascular disease, cancer, things like that, then I'd probably err on the side of body fat loss.
Yeah, I think disproportionately, like if you just look at a numbers game, it's probably losing body fat. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just seeing people at the end of the road more
yeah,
often.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, yep. which is where my mental selection bias comes from that I have to check.
All right, next question. The human body is a complex arrangement of adaptable biological systems that work together to best suit the demands placed upon the individual and maintain physiological stability or, quote, steady state in a given environment. Exercise, when appropriately applied, imposes mechanical and energetic stressors to disrupt that physiological stability and instigate changes in these systems to drive adaptations. Now, the adaptations are specific to the imposed demands and better prepare the individual for similar challenges in the future by changing its steady state. The evidence is clear that regular participation in exercise training is beneficial to health and performance through both increased physical activity directly and exercise-induced adaptations. We know that exercise both reduces the risk of developing most medical conditions and reduces the burden of those already present. Despite these wide-reaching benefits, fitness is underprescribed in modern medicine, with less than a third of adults seeing a primary care physician being advised to exercise. So the premise is exercise is the most effective intervention for health. All right, so I lead off on this one. Exercise is the most effective intervention for health. I'm going to take the negative, so that exercise is not the most effective intervention for health. And I suspect most of this is going to come down to how are you defining health. So where do you plant your flag? Is it, you know, all-cause mortality? Is it health span? Is it some other metric? Because this is an answerable question on some levels, at least through modeling anyway. I would have to say that even though I think exercise is very powerful and certainly one of the biggest fans of promoting exercise, I want more people to do it, although I do appreciate how hard it is to get people to exercise. It's not just going to be telling them to exercise. People already know it's, you know, healthy to exercise, but there are other reasons why people don't exercise. But besides that point, are there any other, you know, health initiatives that have likely saved more lives than getting more people to exercise would? Or, you know, otherwise promote health? And I think you can make a case for things like the vaccine schedule, whether we're just talking about pediatric or even into adulthood. Maybe some screening programs like a congenital, you know, screen, although there's data on that and I suspect it's probably not that high. But some other screening programs, perhaps public sanitation, hygienic practices, things like that, food fortification programs. I mean, you could even go further down the rabbit hole into like some education programs, you know, or like access to education. But I think I'd probably say something like the vaccine schedule or food fortification stuff would probably have led to more lives being saved than if you snapped your fingers and then people started exercising. More people started exercising. Although, again, there's going to be barriers to getting people to participate in exercise. And so it's really hard for me to play this game because – it's kind of like, yeah, exercise is very health promoting overall. Basically, every organ system in the body benefits from exercise, regular physical activity. Even if you don't call it exercise, it's all beneficial. But the uptake is not high enough. And so just assuming that everybody's going to start exercising. Man, I don't know that I can get past that. And even if that did happen, you know, everybody who could exercise, who can, you know, physically exercise on some level, even if they did, you'd still be excluding a certain portion of the population. And so, yeah, I don't know. I'll be interested to see how you come at this. I don't know. Austin, do you have a significant counter to that? Are you of the opinion that exercise is the most effective intervention for health?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And obviously, as an adult doctor, my initial thought did not go to like, you know, neonatal, newborn, you know, type issues. I do not think that screening programs are a huge intervention for health. So I'm going to actually disagree that that screening programs make a huge difference. I think that they are overrated and people will be, you know, probably not surprised to hear me say that in terms of how I think about testing in general. And so I'm going to set that aside. The neonatal kind of early childhood vaccine stuff, that's, I think, a valid point in terms of facilitating adults existing in many ways. Now, at this point, obviously, many of them, to the degree we have a high level of uptake, and you can talk about, you know, population herd immunity, things like that, but that would certainly change if you were to erase that all of a sudden. I'm just going to set all that stuff aside because I think that the childhood vaccine stuff is a valid argument. I don't have a good sense of the data quantitatively of like what's the overall net impact on mortality. But if we're going to like maybe qualify the premise of like the most effective intervention for health in adults or like in post-pubertal adults or something, like, sure, assuming you get through the early phases, right?
Yeah.
Without getting taken out by one of these infections or something like that. Then is it the most effective intervention for health? Assuming that the rest of the environment stays the same in terms of like our general like sanitation practices and things like that.
Yeah, maybe that's
a plausible argument for something like this. Because if you look at what are the other things that can be done like on an individual level, right? I already said, I don't think screening is it, right? So like going and making sure you get your colon cancer screen, I don't think is like what's going to make or break this thing. Other stuff is sleep, nutrition, you know, like social connection, stuff like that, smoking cessation, you know, substance use, all those kinds of things. And so among that population that makes it through that early stage of life, among those sorts of things, if I could choose among all of the interventions, I actually am a bit inclined towards exercise over, you know, dramatic nutrition stuff. My gut kind of biases me in that direction. And then at the current levels of, say smoking in the U.S., substance use, things like that, I still think that exercise, physical activity at the appropriate dosage and for, you know, across the lifespan consistently, I think would be probably have a more potent impact on so many different disease processes, not just those associated with those particular things like alcohol use, for example, because this would impact cardiometabolic risk factors like diabetes and heart disease and all the downstream consequences of that, reducing heart attacks and heart failure and things like that. Neurodegenerative disease, dementia would likely reduce, falls, fractures, the consequences of that would likely reduce, osteoporosis would reduce, cancer incidence as far as it relates to obesity-related cancers would also likely reduce. And so that's kind of my sense of things is once we get that adult stage, I do think it's probably the most potent among the available interventions or like kind of targets that we have.
Yeah, I think maybe my bias is that the uptake is not going to be great enough to really like supplant some of the other existing protocols that we have. But that's just me saying like, look, yeah, you could tell everybody in the world to exercise, but like you're only going to get 20% of folks to do it. And it's like, maybe that wouldn't be the big difference maker that we assume. But in this scenario, if it's like, yeah, you just tell people to exercise and everyone exercises. Yeah. So then, all right, segue. Exercise is the most intervention or most effective intervention for health, or changing the food environment is the most effective intervention for health.
Well, so go ahead.
I think I'm likely to say the food environment, like if you could just again overnight snap your fingers and you're like, yep, the food environment is now perfectly health promoting by any sort of definition and metric. I'd say, damn, I think that's probably the thing. But barring that, maybe it is exercise.
Yeah. I think that I could probably get on board with that. And to your previous point about the premise here was exercise is the most effective intervention for health and not like inviting people to exercise or like recommending that people exercise. It's like assuming that it is actually taken up, then yes, I think that is probably the most effective. But if like uptake is in question, then totally food environment, because the food environment supersedes anybody's like choice or, you know, subconscious decision-making because it is what it is and you eat what's there.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you could say even the physical activity environment on some level for with respect to exercise behaviors.
Yeah.
All right. next debate premise. This is about protein. Austin, I know you love discussing dietary protein intake, so let's keep it going.
Let's do it.
That's right. The recommended dietary allowance, or RDA, is the average intake sufficient to meet the nutrient requirements of nearly all healthy people. For protein, the RDA to avoid protein deficiency in adults is 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight per day. This translates to about 50 to 55 grams of protein per day and about 10 to 15% of daily energy intake. Despite this rather low protein intake recommendation, most adults get far more than that. In the U.S., for example, the typical adult averages 88 grams of protein per day, or 1.07 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day. About half of this is from animals, with whole chicken, cold cuts, and mixed meat dishes being in the top three sources. Now, we know that increasing protein up to a dose of about 1.4 to 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day seems to improve gains from training and potentially weight management results. However, where the protein should come from is somewhat controversial. A recent study comparing muscle protein synthesis rates after two meals with the same amount of calories and the same amount of protein, but one using beef and the other using a plant protein, showed that muscle protein synthesis rates were 47% higher with beef than the vegan meal. Most of the people in the study also preferred the taste of the animal-based meal too. The premise is this: eating more protein from animal sources would be better for health than eating more plant protein. Austin, what say you?
This is an answerable question, and I would say at this point, based on the existing evidence, not even one that is particularly debatable. I'm going to say my answer to that premise is no, it would not be better. And folks who are very pro animal protein diets or carnivore types will love to cite that very type of study that you just mentioned at the end there, where equal calories and protein between two meals, beef and vegan, higher muscle protein synthesis rates in the animal meal, and then holding that up as evidence that everybody should be eating all animal protein all the time. And this is, again, a classic case of kind of looking at these sorts of mechanistic kind of studies, looking at the mechanisms like muscle protein synthesis without actually looking at outcomes like that actually people care about. They can't feel their MPS rates or note that difference in their day-to-day quality of life. It is an assumption that those muscle protein synthesis rates will translate into significant differences in like muscle mass and strength outcomes, which remains to be supported very clearly. The other thing that this study, it's comparing just one meal rather than comparing entire day habitual intake or entire week habitual intake, entire month or longer habitual intake. In which case, once you are consuming sufficient dietary protein to the levels that you mentioned above, it doesn't matter where the source comes from in terms of its impact on muscle growth and outcomes. And then finally, the last thing that is not considered here is literally any other outcome but just muscle protein synthesis, to include your cardiovascular risk, cancer risk, you know, other cardiometabolic, you know, outcomes, lipids, blood pressure, things like that, right? And so, you know, if we can get people consuming a sufficient quantity of protein such that it doesn't matter whether it's coming from an animal source or more plant-derived sources, it doesn't have to be exclusively one or the other, but just, you know, predominant one or the other, then I think that the overall body of evidence pretty clearly points in the plant direction for, you know, net health benefits across multiple different domains, from cardiometabolic risk, most importantly, as well as some, depending on like how highly processed the meats are and things like that as it relates to certain cancer risks. So I would, as I alluded to in the first question, look at real human outcomes of interest that we actually care about, right? Not muscle protein synthesis after a single isolated meal, but rather your actual, say, strength and hypertrophy outcomes after eating, you know, sufficient amounts of these proteins from either source, or even more importantly than just your muscle outcomes, like your health outcomes. Do you die less? Do you have less heart attacks? Do you have less cancer? Things like that. And so once you zoom out to that level of practicality, I would say, of realism, then the answer becomes much more clear than carnivores would like to promote. And I'm not saying that it needs to be exclusively vegan, because there's certainly nutrients to be had from animal-derived food sources that can be super beneficial. But they like to skew it and say, because of this finding, it should be exclusively animal-derived. you shouldn't even bother with the plant sources because there's nothing to be gained from them. Again, looking at this super, super myopically, or actually attacking the plant sources for all the sorts of nonsense that you hear about, like anti-nutrients and things like that, which again, if those mattered, we would see it in the human outcomes of like, oh, people die way more when they eat plants because these anti-nutrients are a plausible mechanism, which we don't see that.
Yeah. So I guess I'm forced to take the negative, which is that eating more protein from animal sources would not be better for health than eating more plant protein. And if I am allowed a little leeway to just to not say that, you know, eating more animal sources would be better, but just say that maybe they would be about the same, I think I can create an argument for that. And what I'm getting at is that I think you can create an omnivorous diet to include, you know, animal sources of protein and plant sources of protein that are equivalent, meaning that it, like, you know, if you took this premise and went all the way to the end and say, well, look, if eating more plant protein is, you know, more health promoting than eating more animal protein, well, then you're saying you should just be a plant-based diet, vegetarian or vegan. Is that what you're saying is the most optimal diet for human health? And I think you can get equal to that with an omnivorous approach, meaning that if you had a similar level, like minimally processed or unprocessed dietary pattern, same amount of dietary fibers, same number of fruits and vegetable servings per day, same average calorie intake that matched your current needs, I think you could basically say, well, they're equivalent either way. And that's fine. And that's as far as I could take this. I do think that in general, most people eat enough protein. Sure, you could bump it up. And I think the way that that works for health is by supplanting and replacing maybe not so great sources of protein, particularly with highly processed meals that have a bunch of protein in it. And I think when people add vegetable matter to the diet, they do the same thing. They get rid of other processed stuff. It's sort of like a health initiative. They're like, oh, well, instead of having this, you know, box of whatever, I'm going to have vegetables. And you're like, well, clearly that's better. Yeah, and then you got some plant protein from your vegetables. But you could do that alongside a minimally processed or unprocessed like animal source of protein, and I think you can get to the same place. So I don't think that vegan or vegetarian diets are like uniquely superior to an omnivorous diet, but I do think that omnivorous diet probably needs to be a little more carefully sort of sussed out than a vegan or vegetarian diet. Although the carnivore people would come back and say, well, what about like multivitamin considerations? And I'm like, sure, look, you can have a shitty diet either way, right? Or incomplete diet either way. But I think in general, having a more omnivorous diet does open you to maybe some things that you wouldn't want to mess with compared to a plant-based diet. Just in general, I think that's by default, the healthy eating index tends to be a little higher. The dietary quality tends to be a little bit higher, particularly in developed countries like the United States.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point that you can get pretty darn close with a well-designed omnivorous diet. I think that both of us would rail against the extremist carnivore position. But short of that, there's a lot of ways to consume a health-promoting diet.
Many roads lead to Rome. That's right.
Yep.
Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is here, and that means a lot of you are going to want to spend more time outside and less time on meal prep, all while staying on track with your nutrition. For many, a meal prep service like Factor can bridge that gap. Now, I've been using Factor for a while now, just here and there when I'm spending more time away from home or don't have time to cook, and it's made my day delicious and easy. Meals are ready in just 2 minutes, and they have everything from breakfast to dinner and even dessert. So you can stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. They also have 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons. I am a creature of habit, but there's a lot of different stuff to choose from, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. So head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. I wanted to take a second to talk about our new podcast sponsor, Mint Mobile. With big wireless providers, what you see is never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price you thought you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again, because when they say $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, they mean it. There's no surprise monthly bills and unexpected overages. They have premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month, and all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/BBM. That's mintmobile.com/BBM. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/BBM. $45 upfront payment required, that's equivalent to $15 a month, and this is limited to new customers on a first 3-month plan only. Speeds are slower above 40 gigabytes on the unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions may apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, next question. This is about testosterone. Again, another one of Austin's pet topics. So hypogonadism is a medical condition that results from the failure of the testes to produce a normal amount of testosterone and or a normal amount of sperm due to disease at one or more areas of the hypothalamic pituitary testicular axis. Now, testosterone levels have decreased over time in the population as the prevalence of diseases that can produce lower testosterone levels have increased. This includes things like obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and more. That said, testosterone levels have been remarkably stable over time in healthy populations, meaning that they haven't gone down by 50% since the 1970s. No, people just got sicker, as it were. Despite this, in the United States, testosterone prescribing has tripled from 2001 to 2011, and it's gone up since then. Additionally, many have been prescribed testosterone without any prior testing, and many of those who have been tested have initially normal testosterone levels and still get a prescription for testosterone. So the premise here, which I'll lead on, is testosterone replacement therapy is overprescribed in the United States. And I will take the affirmative on this, that it is overprescribed. And this isn't to say that there aren't any people out there with hypogonadism or other conditions that might warrant some sort of testosterone replacement therapy or other sort of medical intervention that haven't received care yet or don't have access to care. I'm not saying that. Those people certainly exist. But based on current prescription rates and the testing that goes on and the how lucrative some of these businesses can be, these clinics that'll say, oh yeah, do you want TRT? Come on in and we'll do this other stuff too. And you'll send it to this compounding pharmacy that we have an interest in and whatever. You know, it's a one-stop shop to optimize, bro. I do suspect that testosterone replacement therapy and the ancillaries that go along with it are overprescribed in the United States, mostly as a function of our culture and just obsession with testosterone, which is deeper than just, you know, what's happening in the United States. It's more broader scale. But I guess I'm taking the affirmative that I do think, based on the existing evidence, we probably do prescribe too much testosterone in our country, even though there are some folks who, ironically or maybe even paradoxically, don't have enough access to care to get their hypogonadism adequately treated. So okay. Austin, I'm going to force you to contort, I suspect.
I don't know that I'm having to contort too much. My position on this is probably more that it is misprescribed a lot. Like, I would characterize a lot of what you're describing as misprescribing or inappropriate prescription without appropriate workup and things like that. My suspicion, though, in reality, is that it, if anything, it's potentially underprescribed, because I think that there is a large swath of people who would actually potentially be candidates for treatment, but their clinicians are not adequately trained or comfortable with the workup and process of initiating and managing this therapy such that it could potentially improve their quality of life. I find that to be actually a pretty plausible position here. And that's not to say, again, that there's not problems with these, like, you know, shady clinics that are starting people on TRT with no testing or not monitoring their treatment or jacking up their levels to, you know, 2000, et cetera. That's all misprescribing, I would say. And it could be, you know, you could certainly characterize it as overprescription in an inappropriate way to that population. But, you know, I think about, for example, there are indications for testosterone replacement therapy in numerous different conditions. I'll just give one as an example. This is admittedly like a niche example, but in the context of HIV-associated weight loss, that's a situation that has an indication for, you know, at least evaluating for hypogonadism. I've talked about this before on the podcast, where that's where I've seen some of the lowest testosterones I've ever seen, where there's potential for improvement in quality of life. I've seen so few of those patients ever be on, you know, regular testosterone replacement therapy, because they're often primarily managed by an infectious disease specialist who is not necessarily either always trained or comfortable using this. They have to specifically take an interest in it to get comfortable with that evaluation and management, right? And there are also tons of myths around the risks of testosterone replacement therapy as it relates to cardiovascular disease outcomes, as it relates to, you know, implications on prostate health and prostate cancer, that I think, not unlike the effects of the Women's Health Initiative decades ago on the use of hormone replacement therapy for menopause, I think that there have been some spooky stories told around risks of testosterone as it relates to cardiovascular and prostate outcomes in a similar way that have markedly actually, you know, scared people away from its use. Meanwhile, those risks, or theoretical risks, when studied in more rigorous detail, have not necessarily panned out. So, for example, in the past couple of years, there's like the TRAVERSE trial was a study looking at testosterone replacement therapy at both cardiovascular and some prostate related outcomes. And a lot of these supposed risks in a relatively selected population really failed to materialize, meaning that they didn't actually see a lot of these risks that were previously seen. So I think that, you know, I would view this as a problem of testosterone evaluation, testosterone replacement therapy being like pretty misdirected and misprescribed by people who have a financial incentive in those clinics to just give it out to anybody. And it's actually good that it is, relatively speaking, as safe as it is, that they're not like actually harming a ton of people by doing this inappropriately. Meanwhile, I think that there is a pretty large segment of the population that does come into contact with healthcare who could be candidates for getting their testosterone levels evaluated and potentially treated, but who are not, due to either clinician unfamiliarity with it, fear about potential risks that, again, have not borne out in more recent studies compared with what they learned when they were in training, and kind of failure to keep up with the times and stuff like that. And so, you know, I don't know net on balance how this ends up shaking out. If I would overall say it's underprescribed or overprescribed, I would say it's like often misprescribed, but there's definitely a lot of people who would stand to benefit from it if they're evaluated appropriately. They're just not.
Okay, so then I'm forced to push back just a little bit, and we may be in, you know, more, well, I don't know, we'll see. Maybe this is something that we actually maybe disagree on. If what you're saying is true, that there's a large swath of the general population that is effectively under evaluated and subsequently under treated for hypogonadism or other potential benefit from testosterone replacement therapy, yet they're otherwise not vocal at their clinician's visit, or otherwise unmotivated to seek out additional care, you're saying that that proportion of people is greater than the amount of people being, quote, misprescribed testosterone. And I don't know that I buy that. I'm not saying it's not possible, right? Because we certainly hear the tale of like the person who goes to their doctor and saying, hey, look, I don't feel so great. You know, I feel more tired, a bunch of general symptoms, right? And the doctor's like, ah, well, you're probably stressed and you're getting older and whatever, just brushes it off. And, you know, that may happen and probably does happen significantly. But does it happen to patients who are otherwise experiencing such severe symptoms that we would just assume this person is frankly hypogonadal and would benefit? Does that happen in such a large proportion to outweigh the misprescription? I don't know. I'm more bullish on that. I don't know. I suspect I would assume not, because if you were experiencing all these symptoms, I think you'd be pretty motivated, given how easily accessible this stuff is, to go seek that out. I don't know. That's just my two cents.
Yeah, maybe. I think I probably lean slightly in the other direction, and the only reason why is because I'm not qualifying it by saying the only people for whom this would apply is those with severe symptoms. Like, I think that there are a lot of ways by which, you know, maybe moderate or even milder hypogonadism can impair your quality of life. Yet it doesn't have to be the most severe, like the patient in our original case study that we just talked about, whose testosterone level is 44 and he was fracturing his spine. And so, you know, just depends on where you're going to set, how you're going to set your clinical cutoffs into your decision-making. So yeah, I'm not sure that that is as answerable of a question, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I assume, well, I think it's answerable, but I don't think we have the data to answer it, but I think you
real
could
big data.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. All right. Interesting. All right. Last sort of debate premise here. This is on CrossFit. Again, Austin, you know, has dabbled in his foot in the CrossFit waters. So a recent study assessed 60 CrossFit athletes aged 18 to 40 who finished top 5% in the CrossFit Open, aiming to correlate various markers of fitness with CrossFit performance. They tested isometric leg strength, vertical jump, mid-thigh isometric pull, grip strength, VO2 max, and more. The researchers found that anthropometric data, like height, body weight, limb length, etc., correlated most strongly and positively with performance in the CrossFit Open, with max vertical jump and VO2 max also being positively associated with performance in the CrossFit Open, especially in men. However, absolute strength performance had a slightly negative association with open performance in this cohort. So the premise is, and Dr. Baraki, you'll lead on this, maximal strength is not important as a top-level CrossFit athlete.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. And the main reason why I will say so is because I think that, you know, when you think about the way most of the high-level CrossFit competition events are designed or the tasks that they involve, particularly for the duration of the entire competition, like CrossFit Games start to finish, how many of those competitive events for which you can gain points and like ascend the leaderboard are limited by absolute maximal strength? There might be some, for example, if they do like a clean ladder or like a one rep max deadlift or something like that. But the top level competitors can oftentimes afford to give up some, you know, some spots, some placing in those events and still dominate in numerous other events and still land, you know, among the top tier of athlete. Whereas, you know, if somebody is training to absolutely, you know, like go full strongman strength and pull 1,000 pounds on the one rep max deadlift, that will necessarily compromise their training resources in many other domains, which are much more heavily tested and frequently appear as it relates to aerobic type capacity events, as it relates to gymnastics type events. And so, you know, some would argue, and I'm not even saying you're going to take this position because I don't think you will, that, you know, the stronger you get, then everything else just becomes more submaximal and gets easier, which is, as we've talked about before, just like smooth brain reasoning as it relates to, you know, performance. That's only true beyond the most like activities of daily living level strength, right? Once you get your strength up a trivial amount, then sure, walking is a submaximal squat. But by the time you get your squat up to 500, it's not making running, you know, 5 miles any easier than it would have been otherwise. And so I think that, you know, if the CrossFit Games were designed in a different way, if they tended to much more prominently feature maximal strength limited tasks, then sure, I think that this would become a plausible premise. Maximal strength is super important. And I think you would start to see the types of athletes that win the games would look different. They would train differently because that's what the sport would select for. But as it stands right now, it clearly doesn't select for maximal strength in like as a super common thread across all of the events. Of course, you need a certain requisite level of strength. You're not going to win the games with a, you know, a 225 pound deadlift. But there are many other aspects of fitness that are much more heavily tested in repeated fashion, whereas I think maximal strength doesn't really feature as prominently in, you know, enough events to make it something that is super deterministic of people's performance outcomes.
Yeah, no, those points are well made. So I have to take the opposite, that maximal strength is important to top level CrossFit athletes, basically explaining the study's findings. So thing one, in the CrossFit Open, much to your point, there are generally not very heavy things in the CrossFit Open. A lot of that's due to like just, okay, how logistically are you going to run this sort of CrossFit Open in the gym. You can't have 405-pound deadlifts or 315-pound squats or whatever. I'm not even saying those things are like decidedly heavy, but they're heavier than anything that's ever been in the open. And so you're not capturing the people who are freakishly strong because effectively none of these things are very heavy. Now, the testing also in this study is not very indicative of actual what I would consider maximal strength. I don't care what somebody's isometric leg strength is, what their mid-thigh isometric pull is. I suspect there are people who deadlift a fraction of what I deadlift that have a similar, you know, mid-thigh isometric pull because I don't train that. So I don't think that it's sensitive enough to capture what strength really is. Better test might be a clean and jerk 1RM or a snatch 1RM, which incorporates a lot of different things. The other thing, and maybe in support of your point, is that once you make it to the CrossFit Games or you're at the regionals level or whatever, everyone's strong there. There are no weak people that made it there. So to ignore that maximal strength like is important, I think it's kind of tongue in cheek for you. You're just saying that once you've achieved this requisite level of strength, it's probably not going to make or break your placing. Meaning that if you are already clean and jerk, you know, at this point, 365, for example, taking it up to 405 and dedicating all of those training resources to do so, probably not going to change your performance. It might hamper you because now maybe your VO2 max goes down just due to training resource allocation. I'm on board with that. The other thing here, and the finding that like anthropometric data is like was most positively correlated with performance, particularly shorter individuals, short limb lengths, to me, that's again more representative of the open being not designed intelligently. There aren't as many box jumps, wall balls, other things that favor tall people, rowing. And again, some of this is logistics, some of this is like testing and whatever. So I don't know, if you read this study and were like, just got to get short, and you know what I'm saying? And don't worry about strength. Just worry about maybe gymnastics. Maybe you worry about VO2 max. I don't think that's necessarily like you can't do anything about your height. Okay. Like getting shorter. We can make you taller, but like making you shorter is not really something we can do. And certainly being more conditioned, that's going to help. And practicing gymnastic skills, that's going to help. But to ignore developing a requisite amount of strength, I think is also an error. It's just, you don't probably need to be the strongest version of yourself to be a top level CrossFit Games athlete for a person who otherwise had a chance at making the games. Yeah, there was just a terrible social media post about like what this meant. And the person who posted it they got a lot of followers, got a lot of traction. And their take was like, yeah, you just need to do bodybuilding. So you get leaner and you're strong enough, but you don't need to train for maximal strength. Just do bodybuilding and you could be good at CrossFit. I'm paraphrasing, but the whole post was absolute trash. And I'm like, so you don't know anything. And maybe when you come across a topic that you're not real well steeped in, just don't comment. Yeah. You just pass over it. I don't know. Do you think that my take is completely off the wall or you think it's reasonable?
Yeah, I think we've gravitated in a similar direction as do many CrossFit athletes who train for the games. They gravitate in a similar direction. It's just like the selection, you know, the natural selection of the sport and the way it's designed, the way it's set up, the way it's contested, it's going to, you know, funnel out a certain type of physical specimen on the other end. Yeah. And that's just what this study is describing.
Yeah, the sport selects the person, not vice versa. And if you're interested in stuff like this and interesting findings that are disparate or different across sports, The Sports Gene is an excellent treatise on this. Can you imagine if you were like a sports science researcher in the early 1900s and you were of the belief that a man of the average proportion, the Vitruvian man, would be best at all sports, yeah, right? Like, you'd have to unknow everything that you know now about people in the NBA, about swimmers, about track and field athletes or whatever. But then they must have said like, oh, this person's real tall. They're way better at jumping, you know? Yeah. Anyway. All right. That was fun. That's a wrap here on episode 310 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Great debates. Episode 9. Austin, I think we're going to have to do these, you know, for a while. I just don't think we're going to run out of content. Yeah, special shout out to Dr. Austin Brocky for joining us on this week's podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, Care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.